It's a real pleasure to come here today and actually see this beautiful institute and all the interesting things that are going on here. This is my first time I've been here. And in looking at your website and what you do, I realize that what I'm going to be talking about today is a bit afield from what you guys do. So this talk is going to be kind of a 13,000-foot view of things. I am a computational astrophysicist. My group develops code and applies it to problems involved in star formation and stellar outflows. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about sort of the code part, talk about one particular problem that we're working on, and then in the end, if I have time, and I really will try not to go over, but I'd like to show you this new field of laboratory astrophysics, which becomes very relevant for both what we want to study and our ability to know that our codes are correct. So many people have been working on the problems that we're going to talk about. There's the code development, which is this code we call AstroBear. And then Soren Mitron has been our applied mathematician working on the code. And then the rest, Andrew Cunningham, Alexei Polonenko, are my graduate students, current graduate students who just have graduated, other graduate students as well. In the lab astro part, which I hope to get to, very talented plasma experimentalist Sergei Lebedev at Imperial College. So hopefully we'll get to that. All right, so the problem that I'm interested in is star formation. And so what I'd like to do is just show you a simulation, not one of mine. This is actually what's called a smooth particle hydrodynamic simulation. And we're starting off with a molecular cloud, a spherical cloud, with a little bit of turbulent jiggling. And you can see what happens after not too long a time. The collapse sets in. The collapse is highly disordered. Okay, and so what's happening now, so you see the cloud has evolved. The yellow is high density, red is low density. We're now giving a little spin. We're looking at what has happened to that nice spherical cowl. And now we're diving into a region of looking at one particular arm. And what you can see is some of the gas has already collapsed. There's a lot of rotation going on there, collapsed into a disk. And those little blobs there are stars. So you see, as this collapse goes on, you get a very complex structure. And stars are forming all over the place. They're being tossed out from the cluster of young stars. You can actually even see accretion disks forming where planets might happen. The point of showing you this is that this simulation took a gas, nothing else but a gas, polytropic, index equation of state, and gravity. And that was it. And that's what you got out of it. So even just having gravity and gas dynamics, you end up with something which is incredibly rich in terms of its phenomenology, which you might say, ooh, it looks a lot like, what happens in star formation. But the problem is that there's a huge number of processes that are equally important which are not in here. For example, the radiation transport is not in here. Radiation transport, for a number of different reasons, can play hell on these systems. Every one of those stars should have an outflow coming from it, a powerful stream of material blowing back out into the environment, stirring up the environment. That's not included. There's no magnetic fields in here. Magnetic fields, we know, play an important role in the entire star formation process, from the cloud scale all the way down to the star scale. None of that is in here. So what I'm talking about generally today is the use of computers for studying this problem of star formation. And so really, star formation is inherently a complex process. And you can define that in a number of different ways. But also, the complexity is most important for us is in the sense of being multi-physical. I have a number of different physical processes all operating at the same time that have different length and time scales. And so they're all acting simultaneously, but they're acting on different scales. And how do I follow and treat that kind of process? So I've got stars for collapsing via gravity. Molecular clouds collapsing under their own weight to form stars. And that is a process of gravity, of just gravity plus gas dynamics. But I really have to add into that radiation transport, because that modifies the thermal properties of the gas as it collapses. And so that means I really need gravity plus gas dynamics plus radiation transport. But really, I also need magnetic fields, because they mediate the collapse. And they are what are going to drive these outflows, which can feed back onto the clouds. So really, I need gravity plus gas dynamics plus radiation transfer plus magnetic fields. But the list goes on. Really, there are dissipative processes that are important. And once I start thinking about planets forming in the disks around the stars, I have to start taking into account the fact that I'm generating dust, which is turning into rocks, which is turning into boulders, which is turning into planets. So I need n-body processes occurring in there. So it is complex in the sense of having to do lots of different kinds of physics at the same time and figuring out how to do that. Now, two questions I'm going to focus on today. That are important enough for my group, or that we think are important, that we want to focus on, is, first of all, what constitutes or what controls the star formation efficiency? So I just showed you a cloud collapsing. There was a lot of material around, but some of the gas was turning into those little blobs or little dots, which were stars. But it turns out that even though the cloud may be overall genes unstable, the star formation efficiency in molecular clouds, which are the sites of star formation, that star formation efficiency is really dismal. Only at the best, you're going to get 30% of that cloud turning into stars. Most of it doesn't turn into stars at all. Usually, actually, 10% is perhaps a more reasonable number. So what's going on here? Why is star formation such an inefficient process in terms of the mass, turning the mass into stars? Another related question is, what is the nature and global role of star formation outflows? So every star, it looks like, or just about every star, produces an outflow of some kind. Massive stars, low mass stars. In many cases, those outflows are highly collimated. Yes? The Jeans mass, it's related to the density and the temperature of the gas. It's basically, if you're above the Jeans mass, you collapse. Well, it depends on the conditions in the gas. It depends on the density and the temperature. So it depends. And any blob will be. You have to look at the local conditions to see whether it's genes unstable or not. So it's the genes mass is dependent upon the conditions in the gas. So these outflows are ubiquitous in star formation. They will operate. The timescale for these outflows to be active will be of order of the timescale for the of the entire star formation process. But even more important, the length scale of these outflows can be 10 times or more the region of where the stars are forming. So these outflows can have a very large reach in terms of touching the gas, the molecular cloud from which the stars form. So the answers to these questions affect a lot of different parts of astronomy. Everything from cosmology, if you're asking about the first generation of stars that are forming and how that affects things like reionization, to astrobiology, because these questions are going to control where planets form. And once you start getting planets forming, those are going to be the sites for life to form. So this talk is going to go in three acts. I'm not sure if I'll get to act three, but I'm sure I'll get to act one and two. And the first is this question of multiphysics. Okay, I've told you that we have this very complicated set of processes which control star formation, and I somehow have to figure out how in some timescale less than the age of the universe to compute some of them, and what is involved, how do we go about that process. Act two, I'm going to ask a specific question, which is how outflows feed back on star formation. Clouds collapse to form stars, then the stars drive outflows, and there's almost like a thermostat, or there could be a thermostat going on there, where those stars, by driving outflows, control the star formation rate. And then Act 3, if I can get to it, if not, maybe somebody can ask me a question about it, is this very exciting idea of actually being able, it's addressing the processes which make outflows, but actually being able to create these in the laboratory using fusion machines, creating macroscopic volumes of plasma that you can actually study, make, in some sense, scale models in the lab of some of the processes I'm going to talk about. Okay, Act 1. So these days, the frontiers of algorithm development in computational astrophysics is in a domain called adaptive mesh refinement. Some of you guys may be familiar with it, but for those who won't, I'll talk a little bit about it. So the problem with doing a simulation is that, in general, the action in the simulation may only be confined to some small region of the grid or the computational space. But of course, things are moving around, so you somehow want to avoid having very high resolution in places where nothing is happening. It's as if you had a digital camera, a very high resolution digital camera, and you took a picture of me against a white background. You'd have tens of thousands of pixels that were nothing but white space. That'd be a waste of effort to do that. And if it was a movie and I'm moving back and forth against the white background, somehow you want to take into account that you've got a lot of spaces that are not being used, but at some time later you're going to need those pixels. So what adaptive mesh refinement does is it tracks where the action is. I need very high resolution, because resolution is the key to your simulation, but especially if I have multiple processes that have different length and time scales, I'm going to need very high resolution where the action is at. But I don't always need it in the same place. So adaptive mesh refinement moves the mesh around, okay, or adds refinement where it's needed, and then takes it away when situation changes. And at the same time, I need multiphysics. So I've got to have adaptive mesh refinement that can actually simulate many different physical processes simultaneously. Here's a list of them. We've talked about them before. But it means that the methods that you're using to solve these equations have to work under the very complex situation where I've got grids being dropped down and then taken away. And I have to have high-resolution meshes or grids synchronized with the lower resolution meshes. And that, as things are moving back and forth, that can be extremely complicated from a computational point of view. So as an example of the basic equations we're interested in, these are the equations of magnetofluid dynamics, ideal MHD. These are the conservation laws up here. And then you also have the del dot B, the condition of divergence-free magnetic field, which, of course, you have to have. There's no monopoles. But as we'll see, this condition can be somewhat problematic computationally. So this is just MHD. But of course, I want MHD plus gravity, plus chemistry, plus radiation transport. Okay. So the equations become of mixed type. And they're very difficult to solve analytically. Forget about solving them analytically. But even computationally, it's really very, very unclear about the right way of doing some of this sometimes. So what adaptive mesh refinement is all about is you need some way of automatically adding refinement where you need it. So imagine you have this hierarchy of resolution from low resolution here to higher resolution to highest resolution. And what happens is that you've got as the simulation goes along, you identify patches where you want to have higher resolution. There's various ways of doing that. And then you add grids and you drop them in those locations. And then perhaps then you find that you have other areas that need even higher resolution, and you add those on top. So you're calculating the solution to your fundamental equations on each of these different meshes and then trying to get them to synchronize across the meshes. And that is really where the difficulty comes from. So you have a hierarchy of grids, and then you need what are called prolongation or restriction operators that carry the data from one grid to the other and do so in a way that doesn't violate any of your physical constraints. Okay? Prolongation is where you go from coarse grid onto the fine grid. Restriction is where you go from the fine grid up to down to the coarse grid. So you're constantly passing information back and forth, and you have to do it in a way that doesn't violate constraints. So the code that we have been building, I mean, it used to be, you know, back in 1988 when I was a graduate student, you know, if you wanted to be a numericist, you read some papers and you went into a dark room for, you know, a few weeks and you wrote a code. Like so many things in science, those days are over. These codes are so complex, both in terms of the theory behind them, but also operationally. Being able to ensure that you have the machinery that says, when I drop a grid here, are my neighboring grids, are they coarse meshes? Are they fine meshes? Is it a physical boundary? Just the computational complexity in terms of the code for handling all these different cases it's an enormous problem. And you really end up having computer scientists being part of it, applied mathematicians. The days of just doing this sort of alone are pretty much over. And what's interesting is there's, even though AMR has been around for a decade at least, there are still only maybe a handful of these codes actually working out there. So turned out to be a very difficult problem. So the code that we're using, just to give you some background, some of this I won't go into, but we have a variety of different ways of solving the fundamental equations for the MHD. We have a variety of different ways of trying to ensure that del dot B equals zero is true. That turns out to be a very difficult problem. I'll say that again, and I'll talk more about that in just 1 second. We have built into, up to the current point, we have other physics that we have in there other than the MHD is time-dependent ionization and hydrogen chemistry. We have radiation transfer and driving via Thomson scattering. And now we've just added an elliptic multi-grid solver that allows us to handle things like radiation transport in the diffusive limit, and also self-gravity, most important self-gravity. And then getting this all to run is you have to have it on these codes. Even with the AMR, it takes a long time to run. And so parallelizing the code was really non-trivial. Okay, so one of the most difficult parts about an MHD code is getting divergence of B condition, the divergence-free condition to be maintained. There's a number of reasons why this is true. Most important is just that it's an elliptic constraint on the hyperbolic equations. The hyperbolic equations, which are advancing in time, don't know anything about this elliptic constraint, which the initial conditions had to achieve. So this was really the block to getting any kind of numerical MHD to work. And in the mid-1990s was when the first breakthrough happened, when people figured out how to ensure that del dot B was not zero and that you didn't generate monopoles. Because if you generate monopoles, you start seeing these spurious forces which just ruin the calculation. In the mid-1990s, the problem of how to do this computationally was solved, and only recently the problem of how to do this in AMR, where you've got all these grids that are being placed and taken away, was solved. So what really the problem here was, remember I talked about these prolongation and restriction operators? The trick was to come up with prolongation and restriction operators that were themselves divergence preserving. So that as you went from a coarse mesh to a fine mesh, the operator itself ensured that no monopoles were going to be generated. And this is a simulation of this is density. This is a test calculation. There's a wind flowing from this side inward. This is just an interstellar cloud. And what you'll hopefully be able to see, there are the boxes. Those boxes are what we call hot boxes. That's where the mesh is being refined as the simulation goes along. You can see the field lines being dragged along as the cloud is overrun and destroyed. And what is best is that I'm not wasting any time here. This is all very coarse resolution. All the fine resolution is over there. Okay. Now, this is a test calculation. People have done this test before. People have done this in fixed grid. You know, in some sense, this calculation, you don't learn a whole lot that hasn't been learned before. But this calculation is completely new. Where here I'm going to have really and this is really what happens in astrophysics. I don't have one clump sitting in an astrophysical environment. Astrophysical environments are inherently clumpy. So this is a problem where, using the AMR, we're going to drive a wind or a blast wave through a heterogeneous medium and track what happens. And you can see here all the AMR grids being created and let go of as you evolve along. You can see the field becoming quite complex, the field structures behind this. This is an interesting, you know, we did this as a test problem to make sure the code works, but now we're writing this up as a paper because there's so much interesting stuff happening back here in terms of the amplification of the field behind here as you sort of get a percolation of the flow through the grid. Now notice again, I'm not wasting any time calculating a high resolution over here. But I had to start off, in order to capture the dynamics here, I need to have at least, say, 30 zones, 30 computational zones across one of those clumps. Okay? And if I had to fix this whole calculation with that kind of resolution, then this calculation would take, you know, months to be able to run. As it is, because of using the AMR, it takes a few days. So that's the kind of speed up that you get. Okay. A few days on a, you know, sort of an 8 processor machine. So it's an enormous speed up, order of magnitude change. We're just beginning to get the adaptive mesh refinement working with the gravity, so we don't have any papers on that. We're just sort of working it out now. But this is just some test calculations. Here I've just taken two self-gravitating spheres, and I'm going to let them interact. They're slightly off-center, so they have a collision. There's some rotation being generated. You see, get these interesting. This is just an ISO surface, so it's just one density surface. So you get interesting structures, and eventually it merges down into a oscillating, you know, hot ball. And there you can see the AMR, at least a slice, and you can see the AMR structure being generated. And you can see sort of the AMR is reflecting some of the structures that are being created as the flow eventually merges into this spherical oscillator. Okay, so that's Act One. So that's the kind of things that, you know, these days, this is what the forefront of computational astrophysics is about. So now let's use this to study a problem. And the problem we're interested in is turbulence and protostellar outflows. So there's three points here that we want to address. We understand that turbulence is, these days, by observations, is what supports molecular clouds. So molecular clouds are the birthplace of stars. Molecular clouds are regions of the galaxy that have densities on the order of thousands or tens of thousands of particles per cubic centimeter. They can extend over size scales of 10, 20 parsecs, and can hold as much as, I think this number is right up, I'm not holding it, you know, on the order of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of solar masses worth of material. Okay. So they are the wombs of star formation. Now, if you look at them, what you would find, if you know, is that they should be collapsing already. Okay, in general, these clouds look like they're already ready to collapse. Their pressure, the balance between gravity and pressure, is such that they should be on their way to collapse now. But they're turbulent. We find that they have a turbulent velocity field, and that turbulent velocity provides an isotropic pressure, which seems to support the cloud. Okay. So it's the turbulent pressure rather than the thermal pressure which supports the cloud or puts it right at the margin to collapse. But the problem is that we've understand now is that the turbulence decays very fast. If you stir up that cloud and let it sit there, the turbulence smooths out and dies away very quickly. Okay? So if these clouds are long-lived structures, many people think they are, then something has to re-energize that turbulence to keep these clouds from completely collapsing on themselves. Okay? The star formation only happens in localized pockets. That's one thing that's important to remember about this. So overall, the cloud, if it's long-lived, has to be resupplied with turbulent energy. And but then become the collapse itself. Some people have argued that the time scales, I don't think, because then you're already getting collapse, and whether or not, if you have just one portion of the cloud collapse into star formation, then the turbulence has then been localized in those regions. So getting the entire cloud to collapse, or the entire cloud to be supported by self-gravity, I think is the issue there. So it is one, people have proposed a number of different mechanisms. What I'm going to investigate here is the star formation, the outflows themselves. Supernova blast waves from other parts of the cloud or from other parts of the galaxy have also been proposed. The cloud art, yes. Yeah, in general. I mean, there's small degrees of ionization, but mainly it's neutral. The ionization is low enough that the coupling between ions and neutrals is sufficient to keep the gas tied, the neutrals tied to the ions. So you can go down to like 10 to the minus 7 ionization fractions and still have good coupling so that MHD works. That's where dissipative processes come in, though. You probably have to take into account that there's some drag between them. Okay, so outflows. What are star formation outflows? As I said, every star, certainly almost every young star, low-mass star like the Sun, produced an outflow. Here's two images of outflows from stars. They come in two varieties. You get these very narrow collimated beams. Moving out on the order of 200 kilometers per second or so. These are hypersonic flows, Mach 20. Or you also get very broad outflows that are moving on the order of 10 kilometers per second, sometimes with jets in the middle. These are called molecular outflows because they're seen primarily in the swept up molecules. So these are two examples of two pictures of outflows. In both cases here, I've got a star down here that is powering the outflow. In this case, I've got a star there powering the outflow. These outflows are bipolar, meaning there's one going in that direction and one going in that direction. There's a jet going in this direction. There's a jet coming down here. How these outflows form is a very fascinating subject, which is very much open controversy. In general, people believe there's a coupling between magnetic fields and rotation at the center where the protostar is forming. You've got an accretion disk, a disk of gas, more strongly ionized in that case, rotating around the young star. You saw in that simulation, you actually saw some of those accretion disks forming. And people believe that it's in that accretion disk where you have magnetized material rotating around the central object, that's where the outflow, that's the actual engine of the outflow. So what we call magnetorotational launching is the process we believe that drives these outflows. Beautiful process, quite complicated, but quite lovely. Where you're basically, what you're doing is you're tapping the rotational energy via the magnetic field. It's kind of like a drive belt. And using that to drive material up to escape velocity and actually collimate it. So there's a number of these different forms of this theory, some of which are sort of, you can think of them as fling models, where I've got a strong field in the accretion disk rotating with the accretion disk. Matter gets loaded on the disk, and as you rotate around, it is literally, the matter rides the field line and is flung off into space. The other possibility is if you have a weak field, as you're rotating, the weak field will get dragged around and turn into a toroidal magnetic field, which will be like a spring. Basically, it's the pressure of the toroidal field which launches things. I'll show a picture of this in a second. So there's a number of different varieties of this theory. And what's interesting about this is that it's both a theory of jet launching. It tells you actually how to extract energy to drive you up to the escape velocity, and collimation as well. We see that these are not just isotropic winds, they're collimated beams of plasma. So this theory both provides you a way to get out of the gravity well and then end up being a nicely collimated flow. It's a pretty mature paradigm now. It's been around for, it started in the mid-80s, and people have done a lot of work, including simulations of it. And it's it seems to be these outflows are seen in environments as diverse as young stellar objects, active galactic nuclei, microquasars, which are sort of mini, they're black holes, mini quasar systems, gamma ray bursts, even supernova. All of these systems show collimated outflows, or are believed to show collimated outflows, and we believe this mechanism in some form operates in all of them. Okay. So just to show you, just to put a fine point on it, this is the Fling model. I have an accretion disk. There would be a star here. I've got a strong magnetic field line. The field line is rotating around with the accretion disk, and then material matter loaded on that field line, the centrifugal force drives it outward. There's also the Fling model, or spring model, excuse me, where if the field is weaker, then the inertia of the gas drags the field line along with it, and it wraps up into this coil, and it's the grad B phi, essentially. Which drives the outflow upward. And then finally, there are versions of this that are more complicated, not that this isn't complicated enough, but where you have an interaction between the stellar magnetosphere and the accretion disk. And the accretion disk has its own magnetic field, and it's at this region here where you're actually driving outflows as well. So all of these are examples of magnetorotational launching. There's a lot about this we don't understand. And so, you know, direct simulation, direct investigation of this in any way would be useful. But what we do know is that somehow a process like this, or we believe a process like this, drives these outflows. And it drives these outflows over incredible scales. Okay, so this is another example of a jet. You have the star there embedded, it's still in its natal material, but you can see the outflow stretching out. Here, it seems to terminate in a bow shock as the material plows through the interstellar medium. But in fact, actually, if you take a long enough picture, you'll find another bow shock somewhere down there, and then another one, you know, down on the first floor, and another one. So these things actually extend over huge regions of the sky out to on the order of 2.5 parsecs. That's for this jet, HH34. But the typical protostellar cluster is only one parsec in size. That's where the environment where many stars are forming. So these jets are, you know, are likely crisscrossing the environment in which they're forming. So I've talked about individual star formation, but as we saw from the movie, what we started, and as we look at this picture, stars do not form in isolation. In fact, in general, stars form in clusters with anything between 10 to 100 to thousands of siblings. This is NGC 1333, which is part of the Perseus molecular cloud. And what you can see here, all the green stuff, and some of the white stuff as well, are outflows. So this is a embedded star cluster. There's about 150 active outflows. There's probably about 500 stars in here. And what we have is, you can see this outflow is going off all over the place. This region is being churned by, or appears to be churned by these outflows. So the question is, do these outflows help in providing with the turbulence to keep the cloud overall, the cloud is much bigger than this, supported? And also the question of star formation efficiency. Are somehow these outflows, because there's still stars forming in this environment, so do these outflows somehow change the star formation efficiency? By blowing material away, by exciting turbulence, do they somehow mediate the star formation process such that the efficiency is dropped? Okay, so let's look at this question. Yeah.
How could you tell where there are outflows?
This picture is actually taken in a variety of different lines, different tracers. And so the green material here is molecular hydrogen. And molecular hydrogen is associated with outflows. So by looking at different spectral diagnostics, you can identify material that is in motion or being shock excited versus quiescent material. Which is, again, why the codes have to have all those tracers in there as well in order to say something about the data. Okay, so a couple of points. So as I've said before, MHD turbulence decays on timescales shorter than a cloud freefall time. So turbulence cannot support clouds against collapse unless you're adding more turbulent energy. Another, from observation, we know that the total outflow energy budgets, if you do a zero-dimensional model and just add up all the outflows you see in a cluster and calculate their energy, what you find is that the total energy in the outflows is equal to the turbulent energy in the cloud. So it seems like at least you have enough energy there as a reservoir to power the turbulence in the cloud. Okay. Also, if you look at the typical outflow or the typical cloud size and the stellar density, what you find is that in the lifetime of a molecular cloud, every point in that cloud should be overrun by an outflow at least once. It doesn't say that you're driving turbulence, because turbulence, you know, is a very specific kind of set of motions going on. But it does say that at least, you know, the environment is being touched by outflows. Now, again, remember that, well, actually, I'm not going to get there yet. I'll show you. These clusters are just one part of the molecular cloud. I may be able to really disrupt clusters, but the cloud is much larger. So that question is still open. So this really has to do only with the cluster regions. I still don't know whether or not I can power the entire cloud. OK, so the questions we can ask are, can space-filling isotropic turbulence be driven by needles, right, which is, or balloons? These jets are very narrow. It's still not clear that I can take all that directed momentum and then turn it into the cascade of vortices which characterize turbulence. We'd like to, if this is true, we want to explicate the mechanisms, and we want to make the connection with observational structures. So a number of people are working on this now. This has become quite a hot topic. These are sort of the lists, since you guys, you know, if I was, this is an astrophysics talk, people would ask questions about this part. I'm happy to take, you know, people, if you want to ask at the end, we can talk about what the models that exist. But, this is a very active field right now. So first, let's ask about the question of collisions, right? I would imagine if I get two outflows slamming into each other, that it turns into a spray, and that would help sort of take my directed motion of those jets and turn it into the vortical cascade, which characterizes turbulence. So what I'm going to do is just explore collisions between outflows, and look at that as a function of impact parameter and see whether or not I get any extra motions out of that than if I didn't have, whether those collisions are helpful in generating turbulence. So this is just an early set of simulations we did with the AMR code, where we just took two jets or two wider angled winds, open winds, and ran them into each other. This is an impact parameter of 0. This is an impact parameter of 1 jet radii, so they're just glancing. And this is the control case where they don't hit each other at all. And what we can see is really only in this case is there really a major redirection happening. Even here where they're glancing off each other, there's, you know, some material is dragged away, but there's not a huge amount of interaction. And that is reflective, that conclusion is reflected as if we actually look in detail at the way the mass is distributed among velocity. Okay? Here are three cases. Well, this is a mass versus velocity plot. And what this shows is this is the directly interacting case, this is the slightly interacting case, and that's the interacting case. And what we know from observations and lots of studies is that jets have a characteristic mass versus velocity distribution it goes as v to the minus n with n in this range. And the first thing we see is that for the interacting case and the non-interacting case, we pretty much, actually right here, it follows this quite well with a slope of 1.7. So the collision hasn't changed the low velocity region of the material or of this plot at all. It actually looks the same. And in fact, actually, you'll notice there's actually less mass in the colliding case at these velocities than in the non-interacting cases. This is for the wide-angle wind. You get the same conclusion. The conclusion that comes out of this is that the collision doesn't do very much, okay? And in fact, really, after we thought about this, because we were surprised, but then when we thought about it, it was one of those cases where, duh, of course it has to be the case. These are radiative outflows. What it means is that when you get collisions, energy goes into heat, which then is lost to the system via photons. It's optically thin. So you've got something that's very, it's a highly non-elastic collision. Stuff just clumps down. So what you're doing is you're taking two jets running into each other, and rather than turning into a spray, you're turning it into a very narrow second jet. So basically, you're trading two jets for one, and that just means there's less surface area to move material around. I won't talk about this. The main point of this is just showing that it's the radiative losses in these collisions which actually drag material down or clump it together and keep you from actually doing any stirring. Okay? So collisions are not very effective at stirring, which is kind of counterintuitive to what you might think. So then when we thought, like, okay, well, I guess we should go look at the data, and we decided to go look at NGC 1333, which I showed you before, and look to see if there's any link between where you can see outflows, I showed you that picture before, and where there, and the turbulence. You can actually measure the turbulent velocities in these things. So these are two studies. This is a picture of the Perseus molecular cloud. So now you see the whole kit and caboodle here. That NGC 1333 region is just here, okay? And the cloud is huge. And there's a few regions of star formation, Barnard 5, IC 3348, Fernard 1. This is by far the most active region of star formation. And the rest of these parts, they're turbulent, right? But there's no outflows in them. So that's one question we have to answer. But we just focused on this region here and looked at the turbulence in NGC 1333. And when you look at that, here's a map. These lines here are contours of emission in molecules in CO13, and it's a measure. It tells us we can get velocity data from this. And we superimposed that over the images where all the outflows was. We looked to see whether there was any gradient in the turbulent velocity, in the velocity dispersion. And what we found is the active outflows, the place where there was active outflows, didn't show any, there was no correlation between that and the turbulent velocity. The turbulent velocity overall was pretty uniform over this structure. So there was no gradients associated with the active outflows. And again, that was sort of would make you think like, well, okay, this doesn't work. Outflows don't do anything, okay? But instead, what we found is there were all of these holes in the maps, okay? Here, here, here. It was sort of like Swiss cheese. This whole region was full of low-velocity cavities. And, you know, we did a lot of studies to make sure that we actually these things were actually real. And what we found is that these the NGC 1333, this gas that's the background material that is going to maybe perhaps form stars, was full of elliptical-shaped cavities moving at maybe 2-3 kilometers per second. The turbulent velocity is around 1 kilometer per second or so. And so what we figured out was these cavities were, in fact, the smoking gun. It wasn't necessarily interacting active outflows. It was cavities left over from active outflows. The outflows turn on and then power down, and then it leaves a cavity, and that cavity stores the energy and momentum, and then when the cavities interact or are subsumed by the turbulence, that is when the outflow energy is given back to the cloud. So we wanted to make sure this was true, so we did some simulations of outflows. Outflows that are time decaying, where their power is decaying, to look to see whether the energy in these outflows is going to be sufficient to power the turbulence in the clouds. And here's some simulations of outflows. Here's a jet where the jet turns off after about 10,000 years. And you can see the cavity that's being formed by this is backflow, is a rarefaction wave which flows back into the cavity. And so then you end up with is this slow moving. The heads keeps moving, but the rest of the outflow really stalls off. Okay, and here is an example. That's a jet. This is a case of a wider angle wind, a jet with a wide component as well. There you can see the backflowing. The jet, it's just turned off. You can see material flowing back into it. I won't answer that. Okay. So, actually, let me turn this off. So, these simulations, what we got out of these simulations, I'll show you this in a second. From the a simple analytical model, we could figure out how much momentum should be, we thought from analytical arguments, how much momentum should be in each one of these cavities, trace it back to the stars. And what we found is that the momentum in each one of these cavities scales with the density, the radius, the length, and the time scale of the outflow. And we used this to calculate whether or not there was enough momentum and energy in those cavities to power the turbulence that we saw in NGC 1333. Okay, and based on this, these sort of simple scaling arguments, we found that, yeah, those cavities actually are holding all that energy from the outflows and are going to return it back to the turbulent medium. What the simulations did is it allowed us to check this via the simulations. That's one use of simulation. So this plot I'm showing you here is the fractional difference between what the simulation showed and this relationship. And you see that it's never much different than one over the entire simulation, okay, which says this is a pretty decent model. And that this model then can be used to get the energy budget for these outflows. So what this tells us is that time-dependent jets and winds are going to produce fossil cavities, and that's going to be enough to support turbulence.
I also count on this velocity at the boundaries of the jet with cross turbulence. Is it the same as what you were saying, or is it
different? No. I mean, there's small-scale turbulence along those boundaries, but remember, you know, turbulence is a cascade from some driving scale down to a dissipative scale. So what I need is I need to sort of power turbulence from the largest scales or the smallest wave numbers and then drive power that down. So the little vortices that are being driven at the edges of jets are not going to do it. Okay, and this question now is sort of the direct one of what happens when I drive a jet into a turbulent medium? What is going to actually happen to these cavities? Because what I want is the overall cavity to be, that energy to be subsumed by the turbulent motion. So these are 3D simulations, I'm going to show you a slice through this, of a turbulent medium with a jet being driven through it. So here's the jet. Jet's going to turn off after a while. The medium around it is turbulent. The turbulence affects the jet head, it affects the jet edge, sort of tearing it up. And if you calculate what's happening here, you can see the turbulence. This is decaying turbulence. If there was no jet, the turbulence would die off after a while. And if you look at the energy budget here, you can see the energy, of course, rising up again as the jet flows through it. This is the case of a shorter pulse, a jet that turns off very quickly. There's your cavity, and now you can see the cavity being eaten up by the turbulence. And in this simulation, once again, you see without the jet, the turbulence would just die away. With the jet, you're powering, you're bringing the turbulence back up. Oops. This is just the simulation in 3D. So you can just see the, this is the long pulse jet. You see the jet sort of getting torn apart by the turbulence, and the turbulence forming around it. So this is the beginning of explicating the explicit mechanisms by which these cavities give their energy back up to the turbulence as the turbulence subsumes the cavity. I won't say much about the turbulent spectra. Well, let me just, in the end, I'm not going to be able to get to the laboratory astrophysics part, I'm sorry, but so let me just spend enough time on this, because this is really the key point. So the idea is that you're stirring the medium, right? You go in, you've got a molecular cloud, and you go in, and somehow you stir it up, right, in order to, and then you have a turbulent cascade down to smaller energies. That's what characterizes turbulence, right? If you look at the basic Kolmogorov result, you have a beautiful result where he showed by just looking at the dimensions of the energy per unit wave number, the dissipation rate, and the wave number, that you could find a scaling for the energy spectrum, where the energy spectrum went with k to the minus 5/3, okay? Now, in this, there is always, so that's the Kolmogorov spectrum. We figured out that there was a very easy way of arguing that the turbulent energy cascade ran as the wave number to the minus 5/3, okay? But there's always a driving scale. There's always somewhere you're sticking your paddle in and stirring it up. And this is the question for molecular clouds. What is driving the turbulence, okay? So you have a driving scale, k min, and then you have a dissipational scale, which is at much smaller wavelengths, much higher wave numbers. What we're interested in now here is really what is k min. Can we find, if it's jets that are driving the outflows, can we find some support from this by looking at simulations about something that tells us that, in fact, jets are driving the outflows? Because the spectra are really all we're going to have often. So from those simulations, in those simulations I showed you before, this is spectra, the spectra of the energy density in those simulations. And here is, this is T equals zero, or a little bit after the simulation has started. There's where the jet hasn't started yet. And then these are at different times. What you notice is that actually here, this is your turbulent cascade. You're going, there's less and less energy as you go to higher wave numbers. But you'll notice it actually breaks and drops at large wave numbers. That's because initially we were driving the turbulence by just stirring the medium before the jet went into it, just with little paddles. People call them magic paddles. You're just driving the turbulence by kicking the gas at a characteristic psi scale. This was the characteristic psi scale at which we were driving the turbulence. Now the jet comes in, and what it does is as the jet crosses the grid, it is adding power on a different scale, on continuously larger scales or smaller wave numbers. So you see the power at low wave numbers being picked up here. And that may be sort of the characteristic of jet driving of turbulence, is that you're going to see changes in the power spectra as time goes on. So now what we want to do is run full-scale simulations where you have many outflows driving through a medium. This is a 2D simulation of this. This is sort of a test calculation. So we want to have, instead of driving one jet through a turbulent medium, what I'd rather start off with is a box that has no turbulence in it, and then drive many, many outflows through it and see what the turbulence looks like. Okay? So you can see from this, the simulation is quite lovely in that you see the cavities being opened up and filaments of magnetic field being generated. But I really need to do this in 3D, because that's the only way I'm really going to be able to tell what's going on. So this is, sort of the state of the art for us right now. We're running these simulations right now. And in this simulation, you can see I'm driving outflows all over the place. And I've got a certain characteristic rate, volumetric rate, at which I'm adding outflows into the system. And you can see some of these outflows interact. They smack into each other. Some don't. Excuse me? This simulation? When we appear to reach a steady state. And that's the question, is whether or not we will, as we expect that the reaching a steady state is going to be based on the rate at which we're adding energy. If outflows are only happening, and that's what we're going to have to determine, over a long enough time scale, then I'm not sure if we will reach a steady state. So that's one of the questions. Can you get steady state isentropic turbulence from this kind of process? And what do you need, what are the input parameters in terms of star formation for that to happen? What we find is this is the power spectrum for these outflows, for that simulation. Here is very interesting. So this is large scales, small scales. Initially, this is the first jet being driven. You can see this is sort of the power spectra of the first jet. There's some humps there because of those Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, the whirls. But as time goes on, what you see is that as more and more outflows come in, the break in the spectra is moving over to somewhere around here, in which then you do reach what appears to be a steady state. Okay? But there still is, you'll notice, the power still drops at large enough scales. So there does seem to be a characteristic driving scale with young stellar object outflows. That is a really important idea. Now, we're just beginning to pursue this, but this could be the observational handle that we can go out and look for in real clouds to see whether or not these outflows actually can power turbulence. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take just 5 more minutes just to introduce you to a different topic. My conclusions here are just that colliding the conclusions of Act 2 is that interactions of active outflows are not important. Data show us that fossil cavities are the thing to look for, and the new simulations show us it's the interactions of those fossil cavities, once things have turned off, that really do seem to be able to give you both the turbulence you need, at least on the cluster size scale, as well as give you an observational handle, what you should look for if this is, in fact, what's happening, which is that break in the power spectrum.
I mean, if they're sitting still.
Well, they're continuing to expand, but at low velocity.
In both directions, there's no momentum associated.
This would be what we call scalar momentum, really. It's the absolute value of the momentum. There's momentum in the vertical motions, which if you average over it, would be zero. But here, so it's really what we're interested in is scale. The reason why I don't use energy is because since these are radiative losses, energy leaves the system. So you don't want to use energy necessarily to hang your head on because so much of it's lost radiation.
I didn't understand. What's the structure of these cavities? Are they just hot expanding gas?
No, they're actually, because these are radiative, they are shells of material. The wind has pretty much turned off. So they are expanding, momentum conserving shells of material, elliptical shells of material, inside, fairly low density. So those simulations I showed, you get backfilling off the walls. The shell, yeah.
It's not the cavity as such that's driving.
No, okay, I'm using the...
It's the sort of boundary of the cavity.
Yes. The swept up material that defines the cavity. Okay, so now I just want to take 5 more minutes, and I won't go through this all. I just want to introduce you to the idea of, in the last 10 years, people have recognized that to study systems like this, plasma systems at high Mach number, magnetized, that a new tool has sort of come into play, which is these fusion machines. Either giant laser systems for inertial confinement fusion, where you take a little pellet, you slam it and try and get it to compress and fuse, or what are called pulsed power machines, where you take an array of wires, cylindrical array of wires, and pump huge amounts of current through it in a nanosecond. The wires vaporize and then collapse onto the axis, and then you can get a huge amount of energy being dumped into that small volume this way as well. In both of these cases, people are trying to get fusion, which is an astrophysical process. But what you do is you create macroscopic volumes of plasma at astrophysical conditions. And people have become so good at sculpting that energy deposition that we found we can start doing astrophysically relevant experiments. So as an example, here's what I mean by this. This is a common phenomenon in astrophysics with these outflows, is you get jets being driven off a star, but the jets bend backwards. Okay? This comes because of interaction with the clouds, things that I've been talking about. But in this case, most likely, there's a side wind blowing by. So that is what curves these jets as they drive sideways, or as they drive outwards. You can do simulations of this. This is an AstroBear simulation where I have a jet coming in, and I have a wind blowing this way, and you can see the jet blowing backwards. Okay? But what you can also do is you can actually do experiments of this very process with all the astrophysical theoretical machinery that you want to test as well. And what people do is they take, the group at Imperial College, is they've taken arrays of wires, cylindrical arrays of wires, and bent them outwards. So that when the current flows through them, plasma flows off the wires and converges on the axis and then drives a jet. So they get these converging flows producing jets, and then the radiation from the convergence is very hot. They irradiate a foil, the foil drives the side winds, and then you can create, this is an interferogram, you can create a jet that drives, create a very nice radiative jet and follow its bending by the side wind. And this is where we did a lot of work with this and found actually it matched the astrophysical theory quite well. Okay, I'm not going to talk about this at all. Just want to point out that now some of these magnetorotational systems we can now study. This is actually the experimental apparatus. These are the wires. And what we're doing in this case is we've got the wires splayed out like this. As the current flows through the wires, it first drives a plasma atmosphere rising off the wires. And then what happens is the wires break because they run out of material. And then magnetic field is able to drive upward through the system and inflate a magnetic bubble with a jet at the center. So here are actually, these are radiographs of the experiment. You can actually see this bubble of plasma being driven at around 200 kilometers per second with a jet at the center. The jet goes unstable, as we might expect, as we actually expect happens in astrophysics as well. And these are simulations of the process as well. So it's actually, this is one of the uses of this is actually to test or compare against experiments, the codes in the experiments. And this is actually very, very fruitful. And I don't have time to talk about it now, but I'd be happy afterwards to talk with you guys. But this idea of laboratory astrophysics, a high energy density laboratory astrophysics, is something I think you're going to be seeing a lot more of, both for code validation as well as for touching some of these systems that we really have not been able to explore at all previously. So it's now possible to do experiments in the lab that are relevant to a wide variety of astrophysical topics, dynamos, outflows, radiation transport, etc. So I will close there. Conclusions to the three acts, the importance and difficulty of multiphysics adaptive mesh refinement, protostellar jets, a lot of questions are open on a variety of scales, the launching, the interaction with the medium, in particular driving turbulence, and then finally, I didn't talk about it much, but I'll be happy to talk about it later, is high energy density laboratory astrophysics, the ability to create magnetic tower or magnetically launched outflows in the lab. So I'll close there, and I thank you very much for your time.
Other questions? In your experiments, you've got a boundary condition where you take everything that's going out and bring it in from the other side. Right? Your outflows are flowing out one side, and you're bringing them back in the other side if they went out.
Oh, the numericals. Yes, we're using periodic boundaries.
Right. So in a real cloud, there are real edges where things escape. What fraction of the outflows do you think actually escape from these clouds or don't?
Well, I think it's an open question. I think it actually, for these experiments, we're using periodic boundary conditions because we're considering this volume to be a piece of a larger volume. But I think it could actually be significant, probably on the orders of 20-30% that can leave. Right. But so the question is really there is how much, and I think this is not known, is how much, the amount of mass that's actually maybe in the jet itself may not be very much, but the ability to push large amounts of the cloud, to unbind large amounts of the cloud, that's the open question. So, if I were just to count up the mass in the jets themselves or the molecular outflows, I don't think it would be enormous. But the ability to actually stir up the medium and perhaps contribute to some global outflows in regions, of unbinding the cloud, I think that may be more significant. I just don't have the answer to that. That's one of the things. Now that we have self-gravity, we can do that problem. Take a self-gravitating cloud and drive outflows through it and see what becomes unbound.
Do a lot of experiment. Unfortunately, we can't have gravity working.
Yeah, that's the one thing that we're not going to be able to do. Yeah, that's the one piece.
We need a gravity machine.
Right. Yeah. No, so the gravity, you can try and find analogs of gravity in your experiments. You can try and do things that, will mimic, but I think they're going to be, that is one place we may not be able to touch with these experiments. But there's, is right, is the self-gravity, really. So we won't be able to do that. But there's, huge amounts of plasma processes that we just don't understand, irradiation processes that really these experiments will give us contact with. So, gravity.
fusion machines are similar to what you have?
No, they're off by tens and tens of orders of magnitude. But it doesn't matter, probably, because the equations of fluid dynamics are such that the conditions of similarity in the equations of fluid dynamics are such that if you have the same dimensionless numbers, if you can, you know, if the dimension, you know, the fluid equations don't have scales built into them, or you can cast them in such a way that there are no inherent scales. There are only these dimensionless numbers, the Mach number, the Reynolds number, the Pecquelet number. And as long as your laboratory experiment has the same dimensionless numbers, the same range, or it doesn't have to be the same, you know, it just has to be in this right range, then the fluid behavior you get in the experiments should be identical. I mean, the solutions don't know the difference. The solution doesn't care whether it's a supernova this big or a supernova that's a light year across, as long as those dimensionless numbers. So that's what we're hanging our hat on. If we can get these experiments into those regimes, then we are actually doing experiments, you know, from the formal point of view, on an appropriate system.
So thank you, Adam, again.